In this episode, we are in celebration of dads everywhere. Dads navigating illness or injury, dads supporting their partner's illness journey, dads grieving their new roles in their family, and dads showing resilience in the face of adversity. All types of dads, in all life scenarios, on all sorts of days. We see you, and we wish you a happy Father's Day. Welcome to Wondercast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness or injury. Wondercast is supported by the generous sponsorship of Texas Oncology. Texas Oncology, more breakthroughs, more victories, experts in cancer care. Today, we meet David Smith, father of four, wellness coach, tremendous athlete, and survivor of stage 3B testicular cancer. Join us as he shares his illness journey. Perhaps his strength and advocacy might help you navigate your own hardship. Meet David.
My name is David Smith. I'm 42 years old. I'm married with four kids. I'm a wellness coach at WellMed. Work with 60-year-olds and older who want to live a healthy lifestyle. I'm legally blind, and so I play blind sports, mainly blind baseball, that's me.
That's amazing. I have to ask, how do you play blind baseball? Do you mind me asking?
No. If you look it up, it's called beep baseball, and it's played by sound. Some of us have some vision, and some people don't have none at all, so we all wear blindfolds, and a couple of the positions have to be sighted people who can see, mainly the catcher and the pitcher. And the spotters, so the pitcher and the catcher are on the same team as the batter, and the batter's blindfolded and the defenders are blindfolded. So on the offense, you work together with the pitcher and the catcher to get a hit. And on defense, you work with your spotter who's allowed to call, you know, one number. Number is kind of what zone the ball is going towards. And, you know, if you slice the field up in the, you know, invisible zones, then the spotter is allowed to yell a number. And then it's up to you to track it down with your teammates and your body's a glove, so you knock it down with your body and you pick it up. And so the ball beeps and we have two bases, first and third. We don't have a second base because there's no throwing, but it's first and third. And whichever one's buzzing, the batter's job is to get to that base before defense gets possession of the ball.
That is amazing. I grew up playing softball, so I am fascinated by that. And I love that you still get to have that sport.
Yeah, it's an interesting sport. Yeah.
I will be deep diving that because I think that's incredible. That is so cool. I love that you do that. So what position do you play?
In regular baseball, I'd probably be around the area of second baseman, but it's in our sport, it's mid right. So I'm on the right field side, off center a little bit to the right, about 120 feet out from home plate.
Cool. Thank you for teaching me something new. That's awesome. I'm going to research all about that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Well, thank you for taking time to meet with me today, and happy almost Father's Day. So do you have big plans for Sunday?
No, we're just going to, I think we're going to go to the river tomorrow and then just be at home.
That sounds nice. Well, I would love it if you're comfortable, if you don't mind sharing a little bit about your illness journey.
Yeah, sure. So our World Series for that sport I was talking about is the last week of July. We have like regional tournaments from January to June, and then we have our World Series in July. And so my life pretty much revolves around preparing for all that, you know, working out and staying in shape. And so that's what I was doing. I was just grinding, and we had a few tournaments already last year in 2024, and we were rolling and we were winning and things were looking good. And then I was just focused on being prepared for the World Series, and then I believe it was July 7th overnight into July 8th overnight hours. I woke up with a really bad pain in my lower left back, and it woke me up, and I knew right away it was something not good. And I just started praying, you know, and I didn't know what it was. My first thought was it was a kidney stone, and I never had one, but I always heard how painful they were. And I was like, this has got to be a kidney stone, right? So I remember my dad telling me he's had one before, and he just kind of flushes them out with water. So I was like, I'm just going to go to work. I couldn't go back to sleep. I ended up having to go to work, you know, and I was like, I'm just going to drink a lot of water and maybe it'll subside or whatever. I didn't know what it was, but it was a bad pain. And when I got to work, I'm legally blind, so my wife dropped me off, and I was there for about a couple hours, and the pain just got worse and worse, to where I couldn't keep my eyes open. I was just deep breathing with my eyes closed and trying to deal with it. And I was like, I gotta go. So I called my wife and I said, I think I gotta go to the emergency room. This is probably like a kidney stone. So I go to the emergency room and I'm in so much pain that they just take me back right away. And a couple hours later, they do a CT scan. They come back and they're like, well, your kidneys are fine. You don't have a kidney stone, but you have a large mass by your kidney. And me and my wife just kind of like looked at each other and just like, what, you know? Biopsy the next day, and they just kind of kept me in the hospital for a few more days until July 12th, I guess Friday, they finally came and they were like, well, it's, you know, it's cancer and it's testicular cancer. I was all doped up with pain meds too, so I was like, it really didn't like hit me, you know, like at the time. I just looked at my wife and said, you know, no matter what happens, you know, we're not going to get mad at God for it, you know, like, you know, I knew this was going to be life changing, and I just kind of deep down was like, it's going to be for the better, you know, whether even if I die, you know. But at the time, I was just like, the World Series was a week and a half later. It was coming up, and I just, you know, my pain had subsided, which was weird. Like,
that is weird, yeah. How it'd come up and come back down, yeah.
Yeah, that pain never came back again after I was admitted. And so then a call just came in, and she was just like, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And I was like, well, whatever, I need to get out. I gotta go play this sport, you know, like, the team depends on me. And if I can be there, I want to be there, you know? And so they discharged me a week after I was admitted. And like 4 days later, we drove to St. Louis for the World Series. We lost in the championship game. We came back and early August, I got my port inserted. And a week and a half later, we started chemo on August 12th.
Sounds like things moved quickly. How many rounds of chemo did you have to do?
So it was originally supposed to be 3 rounds. The regimen that they started me on was called BEP, and each letter of BEP represents a medication of the chemo regimen. And, you know, I was diagnosed with stage 3B, which is the latest stage you can have is stage 3C with testicular cancer. So that confused me, because when they did the scans, the mass was in my retroperitoneum area by my left kidney, but it wasn't anywhere else. Like, it wasn't in my lungs or my brain or anywhere else. It wasn't even in my testicle. They didn't even find a tumor in my testicle.
That's what I was going to ask next, because you hear so much about people recognizing they have a growth or a lump or something, and you had nothing.
Yeah, they diagnosed me with extra gonadal testicular cancer, which is like 1-2%.
Wow.
It's very rare, where it starts outside the testicle. Either literally it starts outside your testicle, or there is a tiny tumor that popped up and then burnt out before you can notice it.
That's crazy. I didn't even know that that was possible. So you would have had no way of detecting that until you had that pain.
Yeah, well, I mean, pretty much when I think about like the signs and symptoms, I didn't have any. I had some aching in my left hip, but my sport's kind of rough because you're throwing yourself on the ground a lot, because your body's a glove, so you track the ball, and then the ball weighs a pound. It's a beeping 1 pound. Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than a softball, and it's a 1 pound ball, so most of the time it's on the ground, you know, and you can't really do anything until it hits the ground. So, but once it hits the ground, you're diving, you're tracking it and lining it up, and you're diving to meet with it like you're the glove, you know? So I figured I worked out a lot. So my body was just, and I'm 41 at the time. So I'm like, okay, I'm just getting older, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't remember anything else besides that symptom until I had that pain. And so when I told me I was stage 3B, I was like, well, oh my God, I might die, you know, like. To me, it was like stage 4 with all these other cancers, you know?
It's scary. Yeah, that's a scary diagnosis there.
But the reason why I was stage 3B was because it had traveled, and even though it wasn't in my lungs yet or anywhere else, but that one area, one of my tumor markers was moderately elevated. And so they go off that too to stage it. The blood markers and where it's at and how big the mass is at the same time. And it was bigger than 5 centimeters, so that made it stage 3. Had it been less than 5 centimeters, it probably would have been stage 2. But it was already 6 centimeters, you know. And so all that together, they stage it that way. So because of the size of it, then it was straight to chemo, you know, first to make it smaller. And hopefully get rid of it altogether, right? Like, I didn't understand. Like, I remember a doctor coming into my hospital room. He was like, you know, you're lucky you have this cancer. And I was like, what is that? Like, it made me mad when they said that. I was like, okay, you don't even make any sense right now, you know? But looking back, the reason why I said that was because it's one of the most treatable and curable cancers out there if you can make it through the treatment.
Oh, okay.
And that's the big question. Can your body handle the treatment? And most people, they handle it okay, you know, but mine was rough. My body was having problems, and I know I went into it confident, like, okay, I've been working out for years. My body's prepared, you know. I looked at the statistics. Even when it travels, it still has good chances of being treated and cured. So I went into it, like, pretty optimistic. I mean, you can look at I'm getting chemo my first day, and I'm smiling with my wife, you know, and I'm in the restroom flexing, and I'm, like, ready for it. And then basically the regimen goes like this. It's, you know, it's a pretty rough regimen. It's 3 weeks. Each round's 3 weeks. And the first week of each round is Monday through Friday of chemo all day. And then you take 2 weeks off. But with the BEP, those 2 weeks, you go one day a week and get the B, which is bleomycin. And it's one of the more toxic drugs of the three. They're all toxic, but that one can be extremely toxic to, like, your lungs and your heart and stuff.
Yeah.
Each one of them was toxic to a specific organ in the body. Like, the bleomycin is toxic to your heart and your lungs. The etoposide can be toxic to your liver. And the cisplatin, the P, is toxic to your kidneys and your urinary tract. So I was like, oh, okay. Okay, I'm just going to drink a lot of water. They're going to give me fluids before, you know, they always try to kind of combat that with fluids and stuff like that. So I got through the first week, and I was like, okay. The first few days I felt okay, and then by the third day, Wednesday, you start to feel it, and then Thursday and Friday, you start to really feel it. And then the weekend that you get off after the first week, it's like, it just really hits you, you know? And I didn't understand that every round gets harder and harder, like, builds up at the time. So I'm like, all right, you know, I'm after the first week, I'm okay. And then the second week comes, and I get the bleomycin on Tuesday, and that just kind of, like, lit up my whole upper body. It was, like, bright red and stuff. But I'm sorry, I'm very frustrated with the medical profession right now.
That's okay.
You know, like, they're like, everything's normal. Like, you feel like you're dying, that's normal. You can't see anymore, that's normal. Like, oh, you can't, your chest is burning, that's normal. Like,
so it almost sounds like everything that you were experiencing was just met with, like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I was just like, not serious to them, you know, it seemed like. And I get to the second week of the bleomycin treatment, which is one day that week, and, you know, every week they check your blood work, right? The chemo is going to affect it one way or another. It's just a matter of when, right? And so the second week, I get my blood drawn. I'm good. They give me the bleomycin. I get to the third week, I go, and they're like, oh, your white blood cells are almost zero. And I was like, oh, great, you know, because I'm over here worried about my kidneys and all that. And then I didn't even think about that, you know? And so they're like, we can't give you treatment this week. We can't give you bleomycin. And you have to take these shots to stimulate your bone marrow to make more white blood cells. And 2 days in a row that week, and I did. And the pain was just, didn't warn me about it. I thought I was going to die. I was like, what's going on? Like, I never had this, my hips and thighs and lower back, my spine, my neck are just throbbing, like, so intensely. I never felt that before. And I started kind of, like, pacing back and forth. All of a sudden, my whole chest, like, all the way around, back, front, sides, is squeezed really tightly and, like, constricted. Like, if somebody was put something, like, a vice around your whole chest and just was tightening it, and it just went like that. And I was like, oh, this is bad, you know. I told my wife, I need to go to emergency room. Like, I don't know what's going, like, something bad's happening. And I went, and they're like, oh, well, you have a blood clot in your lung, which is a side effect of the chemo, you know. And they admitted me, and I hadn't even completed round one yet. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, so they admitted me for 3 days and started me on blood thinners, and they released me about 4 days later. When you're getting cancer treatment, I mean, yeah, they delay it if they have to, like with your white blood cells and all that. Some doctors do, but as soon as you're back out, we got to get going again. You know, you can't, like, just wait. You know, you can't wait till you feel good.
Yeah.
Get out of the hospital probably Saturday. On Monday, I go back and they do my blood work, and they say, okay, your white blood cells came up from the shots. We're going to give you the last bleomycin for round one, right? The bleomycin hits you really hard, and you know.
Oh, I bet you felt terrible.
I took a nap and I woke up with chest pain, like, not like pressure, but like burning, like if my heart was sunburned, inflamed. And I was like, okay, I don't know if this is heartburn. I don't know what this is. I told my wife, I think call 911, because the week before when my chest caved in, we drove and I didn't think I was going to make it. So it was a bad idea. We weren't going to drive this time. We were going to call 911. We called 911. They came. They transported me to the hospital and they did some scans and all that, CT scan and all that. And they're like, well, you have pericarditis. The lining of your heart's inflamed. And they must have not seen it earlier. It probably just now presenting.
Oh, wow.
So they admitted me for the lining of my heart being inflamed. A week after, I was already admitted for the blood clot, right? And so the big thing it did was it killed my self-esteem. Like, it killed my confidence. I'm approaching it, battling this stuff. I was like, okay, maybe my body isn't going to be able to handle this, you know? And so, again, I got admitted, delayed to start the second round, you know, another week, right? So that's two delays within one round. I'm like, okay, maybe I'm not going to be able to make this, you know? And that's when I lose all my confidence. And I'm just like, I'm at the mercy of this poison, you know, and these doctors. So I get out. I'm on all these meds now. Like, I went from no meds, working out, playing this sport at a high level, to taking like 15 meds every morning. And my body's changing, you know, like, so my new number now is zero because I went from hero to zero, I say. I start the second round. One of the things I noticed was people who have a history of asthma or of smoking shouldn't be on BEP. They should be on EP, which means you just take out the bleomycin and get the other two meds, but you have to add a round. You do four rounds instead of three. I was an ex-smoker. I had a history of smoking. And I told my oncologist, but she was like, oh, but your lung function test came out fine, you know. And again, okay, I trust her, whatever. And but it obviously caused problems right away. So I went back and I told her, I think we need to switch. In my heart, in my gut, I just think we need to switch, you know. And so we switched the protocol. So we added a round, but the second round was just the two meds, the etoposide and the cisplatin. And I did okay with that. I finished that round. I rest for 2 weeks. And so when you're resting, you know, that first week of rest is horrible because that's when it's all just saturated in you. It's soaking in you. I'm chugging like a gallon of water a day and I'm peeing like every hour for 24 hours. I did that for like months just to keep my system flushed, because if you're dehydrated, it's really going to set in your system and your cells and damage you. And I finish round two, I get to round three. The thing was, they didn't communicate with me very well, right? They just said, oh, take these Bowen shots if you need them. So I'm thinking they're going to tell me if I need them, right?
Yeah.
But the thing was, I was supposed to take them regularly after my treatment, and that wasn't conveyed to me very well, to where I understood, you know.
I think sometimes people forget that while it's there every day, this is your first time ever going through any kind of treatment. Like, you don't know the protocol, you don't know the steps. And if it's not clearly outlined or communicated, how are you supposed to succeed with that?
At about the third week of each round, my white blood cells tank, you know, they go down to zero. And every time that happened again, they're like, oh, we got to postpone your treatment for another week. I'm like, am I supposed to take these shots regularly? They, oh yeah, you're supposed to take them regularly. Well, why don't y'all make sure I understand that? My third round gets postponed a week and I go and I start to take the shots. I found online that if you take Claritin and Pepcid 2 days before your shots and 2 days after your shots, you don't have the bone pain, and voila, it worked, right?
Oh, wow. That's good to know.
I want to tell people, like, man, you know, I started realizing real quick, I need to ask questions. Why are you giving me this? What is this? Why are you giving me this? You know, and when I was in the hospital, a total of three times. And when I was in there, they almost double dosed me. They almost gave me the wrong stuff because they're not asking questions. They're looking in the system. They're not asking any questions or why are you here again? You know, they think you're here from what you were here the last time. We get through around three and four. I was barely hanging on. Like it caught up to me and I was just like, I don't know if I could do this again. Right. So
yeah.
After round four, we do the follow-up scans and it shrunk my tumor from our mass, whatever you want to call it, from 6 centimeters down to 2.4, which is good, but it's not good enough. Right. Like they wanted it less than 1 centimeter. We were thinking, okay, cool, we're done with chemo, we're done, right? No, we're not done now. No, there's more treatment needed now. And the next step was the surgery called a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection, where they open you from right below your chest bone down past your belly button, and they move everything out of the way and they take everything out, like the residual mass and lymph nodes surrounding that area. And I'm looking up the surgery and I'm like, I'm terrified. I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is like major. This is serious. Like this is a big time surgery. it says it needs to be done by an expert. All the experts are talking about are in Indiana or New York or California. And I'm like, how am I going to do that? You know, like the truth is I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to just go. I don't feel good about this. Like I don't, and I start praying. I'm like, God, just guide me. I don't feel good about this. I'm just sitting there. I'm just like, let me just Google. So I put in testicular cancer surgeon expert in my area. And this one doctor pops up from University of Texas Health. So what I learned was these hospitals, they just send you to who they associate with. That doesn't mean they're an expert. They just send you who they work with. I'm thinking I'm going to call this guy's office. It was Dr. Eric Umbright from UT Health. And I'm like, I'm going to call him. And they're like, oh, we're not going to be able to see you for like 2 months because he's backed up or booked or whatever. And I kind of feel like I'm just going to be put in this position where I have to go to the surgeon who's not very experienced because time is of the essence, right? But I call and I tell my situation. I've gone through chemo. And they got me in within a week. And so I see Dr. Umbright and he's like, it's the first time that any doctor has ever told me anything positive throughout this whole journey. He goes, man, you're going to be fine. We're going to get this stuff. You know what I mean? You're going to be fine. And I was like, it's like, I needed that, you know? He goes, but I want to do another CT scan to make sure nothing's changed. Because if anything's changed from your post chemo scan, which was in November, this is January 7th when I met with him. He's like, if anything changes, we got to go back to chemo. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, please, God, please, please let nothing change, you know? So we do the scan and thank God nothing had changed. It was still the same size, 2.4 centimeters. Nothing else popped up anywhere else. And he says, the good thing is it's either dead or it's this other stuff called teratoma. Because remember, there is no primary tumor for us to like get a histology from.
Oh, that's right.
Other than the lymph node. We didn't know exactly what the cancer was made up of because there's different types of testicular cancers. He took out the mass and 21 lymph nodes. A week and a half later, the pathology came back that everything was dead and all the lymph nodes are negative, which is probably like the best outcome you can have. And so at that point, I was in remission. The chemo did its job. And so technically, I was in remission since the chemo ended. That was good news. You know, during chemo, I would be staring off. My kids were like, what are you thinking about? And I'm like, how life is going to be when I finish this, you know, I just kept daydreaming about the day that I was done with treatment and how happy I would be, right? But when I got to that day, I wasn't happy at all. The fear like really set in. I was like, it was kind of like, I just exited this dark forest and I see the light, but the dark forest is so overwhelming that I feel it more than I feel the light, you know? It's like the boogeyman's chasing you now, you know?
Sometimes we forget to talk about the anxiety that follows after the intense experience of treatment. And I'm so grateful that you brought that up, as I feel like a lot of men feel uncomfortable talking about feeling afraid or overwhelmed about future possibility of illness. So will they just now have follow-up scans like every 6 months? Is that kind of the plan?
So the first year is every 3 to 4 months. And then it kind of goes less after that, every 6 months after that. And then the third year is like every 6 months or something like that. I had scans at the end of April, beginning May, and everything came back clear, which means I've been pretty much clear since November 8th after chemo. My tumor markers have been normal. And so my next scans are in beginning of September.
Were you able to work throughout all of your treatment, or did you feel like you had to take some time?
Yeah, I was out of work from July to April.
Yeah, that's stressful. That's really hard.
So that made me super depressed. The mental health was just wrecked that whole time.
I think there are people that are like, hey, I had cancer and I survived it and look, I'm great. I think there are a lot of people that are not great after, and that's okay too. I feel like that's an important thing for our listeners to know is you have residual anxiety. You have financial stress, I'm sure. Like all of that is so expensive. You went months without work. There's a lot more than just the disease. I feel like when you are looking at a predominantly male-focused cancer, like prostate cancer or testicular cancer, it's just not talked about a lot in the way that some other cancers that women face are. Did you find a community of men ever?
The only people I found were on Reddit or online, on Facebook. I found a couple people from other countries that were kind of going through the same thing at the same time as me. They can only do so much, right? Like they can only help. We're trying to help each other. We can only say, hang in there so many times, right? Like,
it sounds like it was a little bit of a lonely time.
It was very lonely. And, you know, it's just, you realize your family is the one you create. You know, it's just me and my wife. and my kids, and we worked very hard to not let this disrupt my kids' lives, and it didn't. They still played their sports. I went to their practices. I went to their games. Sometimes I had to watch from the car, you know, because it was just too hot, and I was just too weak, you know. And
do you feel like your kids understood and could see you fighting and trying?
So the awesome thing was we were told about wonders and worries. And so we put them in right away with Leah. And I asked all my kids, like, were y'all scared? And they're like, nah, we knew you'd beat it. I'm like, man, why didn't I feel like that? You know, like, they were so sure, you know. And I don't know if it's because they didn't understand, or maybe they did or had more faith than I did, you know. But I'm glad they weren't worried. Yeah.
I think as a parent, especially I even think of myself as a parent, you just want your kids to be okay. And you want them to be able to get through your hard too. And so it sounds like whether or not you were feeling it inside, outwardly, you were showing them bravery and strength. And that's huge.
Yeah. I mean, when I was by myself, it was complete opposite. I was in my dark closet begging for my life, you know. But, you know, it was like a blitz. Some evil stuff just blitzed our lives, you know. It's, you know, when you talk about how long the treatment lasted, it's only months, right? But, you know, so far so good, right? But I've read many stories where it wasn't just that, it kept coming back. And then, you know, for some people it's not the end after a few months, it's a year or two battle for some people. And I was still kind of terrified, like, I don't want that to be me. And so far it doesn't look like that's going to be me, right? Hope to God not. But the thing is, the internet, there's just nothing but bad on the internet. I had to realize that. All I was doing was just reading on the internet. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't have no other support. I didn't know. I was just trying to find stories that were going to tell me that you're going to be fine. You know, like, that's all I was looking for, you know, on Facebook, on the internet, searching for something that's going to tell me, who had the same stage as me, that you're going to be fine. And I found a few, you know.
Do you still get to play baseball?
My mental health was bad, and I was like, I'm done. The time I thought I was going to die, you know. My body felt horrible. Like, I went from feeling like this, like a hero, to nothing, you know. So it's like, but my family, my kids were like, well, we love seeing you play, you know, and we want you to still play if you can. I used to be a CrossFit coach, and unfortunately, that CrossFit mentality is hard to get rid of. And so it's like, if I train on my own, I have a gym in my house, and if I train on my own, I might hurt myself. Like, I might get a hernia, you know what I mean? So I asked my doctor to prescribe, you know, some physical therapy, and I started physical therapy in the beginning of April.
They're working you really hard, yeah.
It's still hard. They just work you out. Yeah, so that really helped. Like, I hadn't ran in 9 months, you know. I hadn't moved my legs. I haven't lifted anything in 9 months, you know. I felt, my legs felt brand new, like as if I was a beginner again. Like, they weren't strong. So since beginning of April, we've been building up 2 to 3 times a week. We've been building up the legs, and I feel, and now I'm working out on my own at home in between. And my goal is to play at the World Series, you know. And so it might not be at the level that I'm used to. World Series is a whole week-long tournament from teams all over the place. And so it might just be the first couple of days. It'll be limited probably, but yeah, I do plan on getting back out there. I'm still kind of, my mind's like, why am I even thinking about that stuff? Because again, you realize it's what's important, and b-ball is not important, right? And I took it very seriously for the past 8 years, where my whole year revolved around getting ready for that sport, right? But when your wife and kids are like, we love watching you play, like, we want to see you play, it's like, okay, well. And it is my identity. Like,
community is important. It sounds like you're rebuilding your community, that it kind of fell off the wayside a little bit.
I'm legally blind and visually impaired, and these are where my people are at. There's nobody else around. If I don't go to b-ball, I'm not around I'm not going to be around anybody like me.
I think it's important. I think it's good. So much of what you love has been with this baseball. So I love that you get to do that. That's awesome.
And it's also like, I say, like, the prerequisite to inspiring is suffering. And so I've suffered, you know, and it's time to show the other side of it. It's time to show, okay, this is what happened. This is what can happen. Even if you face death, you can still come back. You can still beat it. You can still come back and play at a high level. Just in case anybody else in the blind community encounters, God forbid, cancer, hopefully they could think of my story and be like, well, shoot, you know, David came back a beast, you know. So if he can do it, I can do it too. And that's pretty much my main motivation, is to hopefully inspire others. Maybe I needed this experience to redirect my focuses, you know, and to really understand, like, look, man, you're chasing the wrong stuff, you know. You're chasing the wrong stuff. You don't have to chase anything, you know. Just enjoy life.
So what advice do you have for somebody that maybe is newly diagnosed with either a testicular cancer or some sort of similar cancer, kidney, bladder, what advice do you have for them?
Be your own advocate. Don't rely on these doctors and don't think they know everything because they don't. Don't research people's opinions. Read research papers about the disease and treatment and what happens and the statistics. You know, read that stuff. Research support groups. Ask the facility what support groups y'all have. Because when it comes to the male cancers, it's not as common as breast cancer or leukemia and stuff like that. It's hard to find a support group.
It's kind of amazing that you made that connection with somebody across the world.
And we still communicate, but
I was gonna say maybe you'll meet one day in person. A family trip to Poland.
Yeah, he's doing good. We were kind of on the same track. When he finished his chemo, it had grown still a little bit. So they went and did the surgery and it didn't come back completely dead like mine did. So he still had to do a couple more rounds of chemo after that. So like other people's roads are harder than mine, as hard as mine was, which it absolutely broke me as a man. Some people had to go through a little bit more, you know, but now he's doing good. His hobby is he's a astronomer. So he has like telescopes and stuff. And he sent me this picture of the nebula. Can't remember what it was called. Like he took with his own thing. He goes, "This is for you."
That's really nice.
And so, I have it saved. And, you know, when I look at it, it kind of reminds me that this isn't it. Like, this isn't like, yes, this is hard, but there's something better. You know what I mean? Whether that's after this life or after this experience and this life, good comes out of it somehow.
Thank you for tuning into our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.